2,382 years ago today, an improbable Chinese mystic named Lao Tzu, working without a research grant, used a simple philosophic algorithm to discover a creative destructive force called the Wu. Scrupulous analysis determined that this Wu brought everything into being, and then, after it had had its little joke, dissolved everything back into non-being. As one might expect, the being went about responding to stimuli, perceiving realities both true and imagined, doing all those crazy things that semi-sentient consciousnesses do. But then, without so much as a "see you later," it executed a kind of nihilistic fandango and reverted to its non-active nonness.
I didn't know you were giving a biography of my existence.
It's a botany, or biopsy.
A biopsy, yes.
Instantly, the process repeated itself. Or not instantly, really, because the passage of time there was irrelevant. Reinventing the process along the way. Mr. and Mrs. Tzu, for Lao worked closely with an imaginary wife, called this process the Tao, which stood for Danny's Algorithmic Oxymoron.
Danny's Algorithmic Oxymoron! All right, I will remember that. That is exactly and precisely the kind of thing I needed to know about that. I've always wondered about that word.
Yeah, sure.
And in the different transliter era of transliteration, that would have been Tanny's.
Yeah, well, yeah. But it's Danny.
I see, all right.
To this day, scholars have been unable to figure out who Danny was, Danny boy, although some believe it is an acronym for something even more arcane. Like that whistle. Down through the centuries, belief in the Tao persisted, although more than two civilizations tried to beat it into submission. As it endured, it changed gradually, an inevitability prophesied by Mrs. Tzu's sister, Lulu. According to Lao, a creative destructive force in her own right, but that's another story. After the Tzus left this mortal plane and moved to Brussels, some of the sect's clerics attempted to rechannel the yin and yang of the Wu. The being to non-being philosophy was discarded in favor of church gaming prognostications, a not-for-profit levitation on demand company, and a witness protection program for faith healers, alchemical engineers, and investment strategy consultants who claimed close visionary communication with the spirit world. The algorithm became less finite, more recursive, until the Tao metaphysic existed primarily in the lagomorphous interstice between truth and half-truth, between being and nothingness, the Ling Tao and the chicken almond ding.
Yes. Just had that.
Did you?
Yes.
My apologies.
Yes.
Though embarrassingly lucrative, Danny's algorithmic oxymoron had been reduced to the dogmatic equivalent of a limerick. But, like the phoenix bird of Arizona myth, it eventually rose from its humiliating ashes to regain some of its former pith. And who should come along to champion the tenets of this apartment complex of theological thought? Of course, it was a bunch of musicians. Yes. fact bunch. Yeah. The musicians were from the Western Hemisphere and learned of the decidedly Eastern philosophy from one of the sect's subsidiaries, Dowell Chemical. Stop it. Many of the musicians were habitual users of the company's brewer's yeast with lysergic acid, a product that provided B-complex vitamins and a quirkily hallucinogenic base. Under the vitamins' influence, they were often able to play strikingly enigmatic music. However, just as often, they might put down their saxophones on the condiment table by the Wiener concession stand and later have no memory of even owning the instrument. I know you're about to complain about the segue, but...
I'm about to complain about the segue. I can... yes, absolutely.
Sergeant Major Balthazar Babcock, Senior Administrative Officer of the Royal Fusiliers Battalion at Lorry-upon-Kent. A figure who has once again been borrowed from a future Calvos and Damien's New Music Bazaar radio program, and who appears in this episode under even more duress than last time, once had to subdue seven members of the battalion band who had ingested six ampules of the Dow Chemical Vitamin Supplement prior to performing in the All England Elimination Tone Row Band Competition.
That's a demolition one for sure.
Yes, that was, how do you say, reconstructing the tone row?
Yes, it was, yes, reconstruction, yes, it's a re...
Recontextualizing
the tone roll as a deconstruction derby.
Wow. Anyway, although they had been eliminated for employing...
Who had been?
I don't know. I've lost the subject. I don't think it matters, does it?
Although the Royal Fusiliers Battalion of Lorry-upon-Kent, right?
Band.
Okay, yes.
Had been eliminated for employing an illegal aleatoric algorithm in their quarterfinal match, they continued to play the same passage for nearly 2 hours. By a striking coincidence, nearly 2 hours is all that remains in the life of the Woo algorithm in this 218th episode, a conclusion that can best be explained by our own creative destructive force, Calvos.
Wait a minute. You made up the premise. Now what do I have to explain?
The conclusion.
I can't explain this. All I can explain is that it's not what I expected.
Right. That's because I was in a hurry to end it.
Danny's
oxymoron.
Algorithmic oxymoron. I like that part, though.
It will come into play again, along with the sergeant major.
And you will, and you will write a piece, no doubt, to accompany that.
Oh.
Using Danny's algorithmic oxymoron.
Either that or the Balthazar Babcock.
Lorry-upon-Kent band, Fusiliers.
It can be fused in.
Even I've learned that. Why can't you remember that? You wrote it.
I can't remember. That's one of the benefits of not having having a porous memory.
Let's forget the memory because we can't remember even the beginning of this essay.
We're
listening to a piece from Spank Me. It's contemporary classical.
Yeah.
The Bonk Festival. And this is Deep and Heavy Love Vibes by today's guest, Eric Lyon, who's already seated comfortably in the studio.
That's progress.
Yes. Well, we'll talk about comfort now that he's a professor.
Thank you.
The beat is back on Calvis and Damien.
They know how to bunk.
Yes, deep and heavy love vibes. That's music by Eric Lyon, played at the Bonk Festival. And this is from Spank Me. It's contemporary classical.
Do we ask him where the Bonk Festival is? Because it is not in your typical new music environment.
Well, when Eric's back and he's, you know, exploring the refreshment stand here at the Calvis and Damien show.
That's right, the buffet table that never closes.
Yes, he'll tell us that this is in Tampa, of all places, a new music festival in the sweltering Southlands.
With big audiences, we understand.
Yeah.
We'll hear more, but first...
A short piece by one of Eric's collaborators, another Eric, Eric. Belgum. Belgum.
Oh.
Belgum.
That
sounds like Belgium, but no, Belgium.
Yeah.
This is a short piece called Life's Big Dream Home. We'll hear more of their collaborations on a couple of chamber operas they wrote later in the program when Eric's back from the buffet table.
Yes.
In the meantime, Eric Belgium's Life's Big Dream Home.
Off course, in the kitchen. Shucking corn. A man sells life insurance. In the master bedroom and den wait two other men with life expectancy charts. They've helped themselves to razor-thin china bowls full of sliced bananas. A sales rep sits in the children's bedroom, blanching bacon over a hot plate. And he's got a life insurance offer that really, if you're completely and totally honest, it just can't be beat. On the master bath toilet, another salesman, holding an oyster and a chrome-handled oyster knife, sits with an actuary standing by at the alert. He's offering free premiums for the first 3 months. One life insurance salesman for each room of the house. And this place has 8,000 square feet, not counting the garage or deck. Let's face it, this place is a goddamn dream home.
Eric Belgium, Life is a Dream Home.
I didn't know you could
Life's
say
Big Dream Home.
Could say Dream Home over the radio, but I guess it's not one of those seven words.
It isn't. And Eric Belgium, one of the collaborators with Eric Lyon, who's our guest today on Calvis and Damien's New Music Bazaar.
But he's not allowed to say anything for 15
no,
minutes.
No, he's got another 15 minutes, 12 minutes before he can speak. Before he can
Do you think he'll do the top of the hour promo?
I hope so. In the meantime, let's listen to our guest. We have some things, that are coming up. Phil Klein is our guest next week on the show. He'll be here live. In the meantime, we have our Calvis and Damien t-shirt design contest underway. So check out the website at calvos.org and click the link for the t-shirt design contest. A bucket of Calvis and Damien CDs for the winner.
And if you have your electric pencil, you can draw right on the screen.
Yes.
Write your image right on the
the Winky
link.
Dink screen.
Exactly right.
It's called
www.winkydink.org.
Oh, gosh. Well, okay, here it is. Phil Klein, our guest next week. Here is his piece, Franz in the Underworld.
France in the Underworld, from a CD called The Alternative Schubertiade. That's music by Phil Klein. The Alternative Schubertiade, a very... Cool. Oh, wait, there's more of the same... Wait, we can't listen to any more of that.
Does that count as a play? Does that count towards our quota?
Towards our quota, maybe, maybe not, I don't know. I'm very having trouble getting used to this microphone because its little sock is missing.
Oh.
So if I get too close to it, I get too loud.
That's right, but...
I need the little sock.
Put a sock. You're wearing two. You don't need both of them.
We're going to go a little bit past the hour on this next one, and then we'll have Eric Lyon join us. We're going to play something by Kevin Austin. This is called Static Gestures 2, Formant Pulses. Kevin Austin, one of the leaders in the Canadian electroacoustic community that's now having a big argument over recent developments in the field of digital music, as it were. Here's Kevin Austin's Static Gestures 2.
My name is Dr. Eric Lyon, and it is my great pleasure to inform you that you are listening to Calvos and Damien's New Music Bazaar, your red alert for new music.
And you're listening to it here on WGDR Plainfield and Cybercast in real audio and MP3 from www.goddard.edu/calvos.
Also available at Kmart in the bins.
Yes, in the free section, in the discounted bins. And our guest is Eric Lyon, and that is not his music in the background that we've just turned down. That's Kevin Austin's piece created on the old 1979 or 80 vintage synthy sequencer called Static Gestures. I guess that's part of the retro movement that's in process today.
It is. In process, however, is maybe not the correct term to use in that case.
Yes, especially now, because our show is called...
That's a double CD?
It's a double CD, yes.
Sorry, excuse my...
It doesn't go with today's theme, which is The Beat is Back, because we got Eric Lyon here. Hi, Eric.
Hello.
Hey, let's turn your microphone up a little bit there. There we go. Good. Well, welcome to the show. We're really, really glad to have you here.
Well, we're mostly glad. We're not really, really. We're mostly glad
to
have you.
Well, I'm really, really glad.
Depending on what he has to offer.
And the level of joy I expect to go down as the day progresses.
Yes.
However, I expect my level of joy to go up.
Yours will. I'm certainly it will. Hey,
regardless.
So how did you get? You're like the professor now there at Dartmouth, and you're a kind of an unlikely professor. We've played some of your stuff on the show before, and we never saw professors jumping out of that music.
Well, maybe not professional, but professor, yes. Well, this has been one of my life's cherished goals. From when I was 4 or 5 years old, I always said I want to be a professor at a good university. And
that's
what happened.
I'm sure people dream that all the time.
Oh, yeah.
It just goes to show you that if you want it enough and nobody else wants it in your place, then it can happen.
Well, I had to kill a few people.
Oh, that's not a problem.
But I just want to say that it didn't just fall in my lap. It was somewhat proactive. I did have to make sure that a couple of people had unfortunate accidents.
Yes. So where did you come from on your way to making these unfortunate accidents?
I came from making unfortunate accidents in Japan.
And you spent how long there, and why?
5 years, and why? Well, there's no real reason. I just kind of stumbled into it and found that I liked it. I think most people most Americans who wind up in Japan really find themselves a little bit confused about why they're there, but generally pretty happy.
And you were confused and happy?
Oh, yes, from the very start.
So why did you leave?
Well,
or were you exported?
I'm an export commodity, and I may go back at the drop of a hat. Who knows?
That's the end of tenure is called the drop of a hat.
Yes.
Well, that's called the hammer comes down.
And you went to school where? You studied me. How did you get into composing? And we're going to hear some of your music, and it is really very diverse and unusual and certainly has, you called it conservative, and in some respects we can talk about it as that, but in others quite not. So how did you get into it?
How did I get into it? Well, I fell into it again. I became very enamored of the music of Paul Hindemith when I was about 11 and started buying Hindemith records. And shortly after that, it occurred to me that, well, this is so much fun. Why shouldn't I do it too? So I just started composing some pieces. I had studied violin since I was about 5, and so I started writing pieces for 2 violins, and then after a while I decided I could write for other things too. So I just kept on doing it, and that was pretty much it. So I was doing instrumental music since I was about 11, and when I got to college, I was at Princeton, where they have quite a bit of computer music and have for quite a while.
Yeah, it's one of the original sources of that, the famous Columbia-Princeton electronic music studios.
That's right, with Bell Labs.
Right.
And as a New Jerseyan, I'm very, very proud to recall at any time that computer music was invented in New Jersey. But because of proximity to Paul Lansky, I got into...
And Paul is still at Princeton.
Most certainly.
Yeah.
Yes, he's cranking out really
wonderful
pieces.
A lovely CD came out, I think, last year called Things She Carried.
That's right. Yeah. That's a beautiful CD. Anyhow, after I left Princeton, I went to Eastman, And that's where I really got into computer music. There was a small...
It's kind of a band school.
A band school, yeah. Because of Frederick Fennell, right?
Yeah.
Right, and Howard Hanson.
Yep.
Well, I remember that the story going around Eastman was that one of Howard Hanson's proudest achievements was not giving Bartok a job when he looked for it, because it was a little bit too avant-garde for him. And we definitely had the example of professors there telling students not to play contemporary student works. But in many ways, that was quite good, because... You know, most of the places I've gone, people have been pretty apathetic to contemporary music. I mean, they could take it or leave it. But at Eastman, there was a block of resistance, and of course, that made us try to be as obnoxious about it as possible. And of course, you know, the best way to get people to do something is to tell them not to do it.
Yeah, sure.
So the professors who were telling their students not to play our music were doing us a big favor. And there were a few people I hooked up with, Paul Reller and Robert Constable and a few others, Todd Levin that we talked about earlier. And we just started doing things that were fun for us. And part of what was fun for us was experimenting with sound on computer. So I got into computer music that way and never really lost the interest for it.
But, you know, a lot of what you do, and we'll hear a variety of things, is not what you would classify as the kind of grandfatherly kind of computer music of noises. Now, we do have a couple of examples of stuff. We have one that is entirely opposite from that, which is a piece you wrote for Margaret Lancaster.
Right.
And we also have something from a CD called Red Velvet, and they're about as different as you get. And we're going to hear both of those. But give us a preface to first of all, this one piece that you wrote for Margaret Lancaster called Heavy Rotation, and then give us a little talk about a good piece from Red Velvet so we can hear one against the other.
Okay, and you can mix and match and see which one you like better, and I hope people will call in to vote. and whichever one you like better, I'll try to write more in that style in the future. Heavy Rotation was the second piece I wrote for Margaret for percussion and flute. The first was Double Globe, and Double Globe was basically named after a brand of heroin that was very popular in Vietnam during the war. And I just really liked, actually it's Double VO Globe, but I really liked the sound of Double Globe because it seemed like a vaguely sexual term. So anyhow, I thought, you know, because it was a duo, it would be a good name. It had absolutely nothing to do with the music itself. I took the melody from a pop song I had written earlier called Girl in a Wheelchair and basically submitted that to a series of variations. But anyhow, that was Double Globe. After that, I wanted to... that piece was really a much more sort of serious academic piece. And for Heavy Rotation, I really wanted to use pop music techniques and apply them to basically new complexity sounds. In other words,
yeah. Explain briefly about new complexity, because you were a student of Brian Fernyhough.
That's correct. And the idea of new complexity, I think, at first was a few English composers in the 70s who were really annoyed with the fact that nobody wanted to play their music.
That would be Fernyhough and Richard Barrett and...
Yeah, probably Fernyhough and maybe Michael Finnessy.
Finnessy, yeah.
Barrett is a bit younger, although, of course, he was in that school later. They said, well, okay, if you're not going to play our music anyway, we're going to write unplayable music, and we're going to write deliberately and ridiculously unplayable music. And, of course, as soon as you do that, it becomes a challenge, and then people go out of their way to try and play it. And so after that, of course, a critic came up with the name New Complexity. Of course, you know, if you're going to be doing anything important, it has to be new.
It has to have a name.
Right. So it was complex, and it was new. Anyhow, while I was studying with Brian, I came up with a few genres of my own. One was New Complexity Light, which is to use the new complexity style and superimpose a disco beat. The idea being that actually that was more complex than New Complexity, because it had all of the complexity of New Complexity, but it also had the multiplicity of having a disco beat and also all this weird stuff happening on top of it. But then I got into another idea that I liked a lot better, which is the new sensitivity. Because I felt that, you know, what was happening in academic music was that people were just too into techniques. And I was really very interested in techniques. I really like the idea of technique as something that makes music really cold and unemotional and forbidding. When I got into it, I mean, that was very appealing to me. But I thought that, you know, part of you know, keeping yourself, reinventing yourself, keeping yourself fresh, and essentially manufacturing yourself as a composer personality has to do with reinventing yourself. So after I had pushed myself to the extremes of cold, forbidding, intellectual, academic music, I decided to discover that I had emotions too. So that was when I invented the new sensitivity.
And you decided to discover. This is good.
Yes. So I discovered that. And, of course, whenever I would have a new genre, which would usually be for one every two pieces or so that I composed when I was in San Diego, I'd have a manifesto that would be part of the program notes announcing my new style. More recently, I'd been involved in what I called strap-on classical music. Strap-on classical was based on the idea, it's sort of a postmodern idea, which is that all these different genres are out there, and in a sense, you're not so much making a pastiche as you're putting something on. And of course you could say, well, you're putting on a mask, but it didn't feel that way when I was composing, and so I wanted to have something that would be more expressive of the compositional of the compositional process. And so strap-on classical really seemed to capture it for me. That even though I had started out as a classical music composer, writing classical music now was essentially a strap-on operation. But that's more recent. I mean, going back to heavy rotation, the idea was to adopt some of the techniques of pop music. And in particular, I wanted to adopt the idea of a hook. And the idea of a hook, of course, is that in order to make something stick in your mind so that you want to buy the album, you have to use the Wagnerian leitmotif idea. You just have a very small idea, and you just repeat it over and over again.
Sure, like when I get the Marineland theme stuck in my head.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. So my idea was to use that technique, but as an experiment, since, of course, I have to consider myself as an experimental composer, if classical musicians are going to take me seriously.
Yes, and if you're to stay a professor.
Of course. Well, that's another issue altogether. I think as far as the former issue, that's, as they say, we're well beyond that now. As to the latter, it remains to be seen.
Uh-huh.
But the experiment was, well, what if you apply the idea of the hook to absolutely unmemorable, unlistenable, totally complex, and unrepeatable music. And I was also inspired by a quote that Brian Ferneyhough told me about Irvin Arditi, when Arditi was playing through Ferneyhough's violin concerto.
He's one of the great performers of contemporary music.
One of the great new music performers. And he said, it's a very good thing that there were no repeats in this piece, because, of course, you know, he would have played it totally different
the second time.
So I thought, okay, I'll make a little snippet of new complexity material, and it'll just keep on coming back over and over again, and that's the only thing that's going to repeat, and everything else in the piece would be so transparent and inane that it would, in a sense, provide a good backdrop for it. So that's basically the story of Heavy Rotation, other than that it's the first instrumental piece I wrote in Japan. So I tried to give it a bit of an Eastern feel by using a woodblock and a bass drum.
We'll be able to hear the Dow influence.
You'll get the Dow Jones influence.
Oh, yes, sure. The algorithmic oxymoronism. Here it comes.
Yes, moronism.
Yes.
Maybe, I'm not sure if there are any oxes in there.
Music by Eric Lyon. Here it is, performed by Margaret Lancaster. Heavy Rotation.
Heavy Rotation, that's music by Eric Lyon, performed by Margaret Lancaster and Paul Reller on the percussion. And what did you call that? You called it something.
Did I call it...
Piece of dreck.
Mindless dreck.
Mindless dreck. While
yes.
We were...
I was doing that to highlight the contribution of the performers. I think that very often composers don't give enough credit to what the performers bring to their music.
Oh, right. Sometimes we can overcompensate, but that's another story.
That's right. But, I mean, fortunately, when a piece has no artistic content to begin with, it starts as a sort of a blank slate, and then when you have truly great performers, they can really fill out the space, so to speak.
Yeah.
So, why did you give this to them if it was a piece of dreck?
Because it was the best piece I had for the ensemble. Otherwise, they would have had to play Double Globe, and the results might have been truly controversial.
It's funny you brought up Double Globe and all of that, because the piece that I had queued up next was a piece called Psychedelic Relapse from your CD, Red Velvet.
Great.
Tell us about that.
Well, I mean, it's a kind of an imaginary. I mean, I've never really taken any psychedelic drugs ever, so I just kind of tried to imagine what would happen if you had a relapse from an experience that you never had. But more technically speaking, it's a kind of second-order refuse, or detritus, because this piece was basically written with a bunch of other computer music pieces on the CD that you have Red Velvet put out by my company, which is Smart Noise Records. We've put out one record so far. I think we've sold about 25 copies.
So that's been very good.
Doing pretty well.
But
actually, I'm expecting to maybe sell another 25 copies because there's allegedly going to be an article in Pulse magazine of Tower Records that's going to have some mention of the CD.
Excellent.
Not to mention the buying public that listens to this radio program.
Yes,
that's
right.
Right. So this will probably be one of the pieces in our CDs in our group of 25 that goes to the winning CD designer.
Grab bag OCDs.
Winning T-shirt designer, that is. So, yeah.
That's right. It's going to be a great present. So, and the thing is, when you get a CD like that, I mean, you can just keep on reusing it as a present. I mean,
all kinds of ways, right?
Yeah,
it goes from hand to hand, spreading that message of, as you say here, the world of post-experimental computer music, addressing traditional issues of expression and cultural encapsulation through the organizational and decision techniques inherent in programmable operating systems. What?
I believe I said something to that effect earlier in describing the Double Globe piece.
Post-experimental computer? That means you don't experiment anymore?
That's right. I don't have to experiment. It's a gift.
I think we better hear it. Here it is, music by Eric Lyon, Psychedelic Relapse.
There should be a feeling of joy. Thank you.
Sounded psychedelic to me.
I'll say I was tripping myself, just the way Dow Chemical had their product.
Were you feeling gamma rays?
Gamma rays. That's right.
You were suggesting we should have some raves up here. You thought this was sort of a quaint area for raves.
Oh, absolutely. As a matter of fact, I mean, just invite me up anytime, and I'll bring three or four new music aficionados. We'll play
only
some
three or four is enough for a raid.
Well, right? we'll play some Milton Babbitt and put on some breakbeats behind it. I think it'll be fun.
You collaborated with the other composer we played a little bit of earlier, Eric
Belgum. Eric Belgum.
Boom.
Eric Belgum is the greatest writer of the 20th century. So it's naturally as the greatest composer of the 20th century, I would be drawn to collaborate with him. That's sort of like Mozart and Mersenne or whoever he worked with.
You've done two chamber operas and a third coming up? Is
yes.
that the deal?
The third is coming up, although so far everyone I've described the synopsis to has been so revolted that we're wondering if maybe it's more than our audience can take.
I guess you'll have to tell us about it then.
Oh, I think it would probably be a little bit... Well, let's see. It's after three, right? So
I can.
Well, basically, in the second opera, which we're going to hear a selection from, the insane drill sergeant is audited by Satan, by Lucifer, the bringer of light, and he loses all his money, and his wife makes fun of him and henpecks him the whole time, but he still wants to have some wars. Because otherwise, I mean, that's his job. So he decides that the best place to have wars is in Central America. So he's going to go down there and start some wars. But then he realizes he doesn't have any money. And you can't have a war without any money. That's why we had the whole thing about the audit causing him problems. He's audited. He doesn't have any money. Can't have a war. So he gets this great idea for how to get the money. He's going to start a chain like Kinko's of abortion clinics in Central America. Take the fetal tissue and then sell it on the black market to North America, especially to aging politicos with degenerative brain illnesses like Parkinson's. Anyhow, I mean, when I proposed this recently, and
you didn't get a great reception at Dartmouth?
Well, the person I proposed it to, I could just see the eyes glazing over and the sort of the looking over your head.
Where did the glazing begin exactly? What phrase did you use?
I think it was the chain of abortion clinics and
the glaze
and
started.
The fetal tissue.
Fetal tissue.
It was going
more
up.
Glaze.
And I mean, I was really tempted to just. Well, then when I mentioned
back to the piece. Yes.
No, but when I told her that there were some dance segments, there were two fetus dances already. But I had requested that we have a pro-life square dance at the end for the two fetuses, the priest, and little Jimmy Watkins, the newspaper boy. That's when she told me that it really was not the sort of thing they were looking for.
That's when her nictating eyelids just went. Yes.
I was under the impression that Douglas Moore already wrote this back in the 50s.
Is that correct?
I think so, yeah. There were a couple of metaphors that maybe he didn't get that you have very clear.
Who's Douglas Moore?
Oh, please.
Okay.
Oh, please. One of our favorite composers. We don't play him enough.
Ah. Do you ever play him?
I think we did once
was
by
the
mistake.
The perambulator composer?
Yes, that's him.
I see. All right, yes. The fetal perambulator.
One other thing I'd like
one other thing before we hear this.
Point out is
and we're going to simultaneously bleep when we get to certain
okay.
places.
Can we all bleep at the
we
same time?
We can bleep, yes.
Let's practice. One, two, three.
Bleep!
Okay.
Bleep.
That's pretty good. But louder. One, two, three. Bleep!
Bleep!
There you go. Okay. Anyhow, one of the reasons we were inspired to go ahead with the second opera, I think we maybe sold 5 or 10 copies of the first opera, and this was after we had a couple different sales techniques. Eric Belgum really came up with them. One is suggest to sell the CD to someone, and they say, how much is it? And you say, $10. If there's any hesitation at all, you say, no, $5. any more, $2. And you say, no, here, give it away. And the other thing is we were planning to sell them with the wrapping still on to used CD stores for like $1.50. Well, anyhow, but the thing that really made us want to go ahead and with the second opera is that Eric got an email from this scientist in France who had gotten his hands on the first retirement fund opera and totally loved it. It was his favorite thing, and he was listening to it over and over again. And Eric said, how did you ever get your hands on this CD? And he said, oh, I found it in the garbage outside of our building.
Where it was thrown by Charles Amerkanian. Wow. He was doing.
Well, I was thinking maybe Eric found an even better way to distribute our work.
Yeah, absolutely. Throw new CDs into garbage cans. And people say, they can't throw that away. It's brand new.
There you go.
I like that.
There you go.
Let's hear this, and we'll bleep as appropriate. Here it is. They're Sucking Us Dry from this collaboration between Eric Lyon and Eric Belgum called The Audit, the number 2 from Retirement Fund. They're Sucking Us Dry from Retirement Fund number 2, which also has a great finale. I think we should listen to a little bit of as well. The whole piece is just, I mean, it's black and it's bleak and it's not funny at all, except it's funny. It's just great. Let's listen to part of this conclusion here. This is the, what's this called? I can't remember. Three Strangers. This is the final cut from number 2, Retirement Fund, The Audit. Oh, I love audits.
Three of us went through a lot in this gray room today. The three of us got all dressed up and came downtown today. Three strangers till the day we came downtown. Three people in an office room, and as those gray walls surrounded what was crashing down inside,
office room. Three people in an office room.
The three of us went through a lot in this gray room today.
Just had a caller who said that's really the Kinks, right?
Well, that's a really great great compliment. I mean, the Kinks, as I recall, were able to sing in tune.
Well, I think...
But you know, here we have Professor Eric Lyon himself on vocals and bass.
Assistant professor.
Well,
thank you.
I mean, professor is, you know, it doesn't matter what the modifier is. It's academic.
The super professor.
Oh, we need more historical context. What can we hear next?
Well, how about thalidomide?
Yeah.
Thalidomide.
Tell us about this and what brought this on.
Actually, nothing much, really. This is one of my most boring pieces. But
boring? No. Yes. To explain.
We don't play boring pieces on the red alert for new music.
That's right. But I mean, since you have me on, you really don't have much choice. I said most boring.
We can skip through.
They're all pretty. That's right. You can fast forward. Might sound better that way. Well, we just happened for the Bonk Festival, which is something I do with my friends out in Tampa every year. We got ourselves a wind ensemble. So we all wrote pieces, and I wanted to try my hand at writing some large ensemble music, since it had been a long time since, you know, any large groups of musicians would get within 10 feet of a score of mine. So I decided to just, you know, have some fun and be sort of like the genie in the bottle who finally gets out and takes instant revenge on the people who let him out of the bottle. So in a sense, I have this idea of performer verification, because, you know, it's really fascinating. At the same time that there's this what's called historically informed performances, where people rebuild harpsichords and try to figure out exactly what pitch
natural horns were used.
Mediocre pieces from the 17th century, you know, how they were supposed to be played, and they put all this energy into it. You know, most people just kind of fake their way through new music pieces. And so finally, I had enough of this, and around the time I was working on the Strap-On Classical manifesto, I came up with a technique called performer verification. Basically, the idea of performer verification is that no matter what happens, the composer comes off looking great, but if the performer makes a mistake, performer looks like a chump.
So, yeah, Margaret Lancaster actually described this to us during her interview about how you kind of dropped that on her head.
Right.
Yeah.
Anyhow, I mean, performer verification, I had been using that for a few years, so I decided then in thalidomide, what I would use is artificial performer verification. What artificial performer verification is that if the performer performs the piece correctly, they also look like a chump. So that's also basically what it is. So why don't we spin it and see what happens?
Here it is, The Little Mind by Eric Lyon.
Thank you.
Boy, you just don't hear music like that on the radio
anymore. No, sir. I certainly did like that lost double reed player there, just waiting for the rest of the group to pounce. Thalidomide, that's by Eric Lyon. That's a revenge piece, you said?
Oh, well, you know.
We don't get to keep that?
I'll run you off on
an 8-track. That would be better.
I wouldn't call it a revenge piece exactly. I would call it more instant gratification orchestration piece.
I'm sure there are people listening who are thinking, well, he's got all these skills. Why is he trying to be funny so much?
I don't think that's funny. Do you?
Well, I guess not.
Oh, his side's hurt for some other reason, I'm sure.
Well, I don't know. I just try to write music that cracks me up a little bit.
Too much seriousness in the world of contemporary music.
Oh, but we'll try to end with a serious piece, though.
All right.
This is one of your academic influences?
No, this is pre-academic. This is my sort of last chance to write a really nasty electronic piece before joining the club.
Ain't no club here.
No, not here.
Well, yeah, we have time for a couple more pieces, so let's do Bongo Bonzo.
Okay.
Yeah, how did that one come about? We played that, gosh, it must be 3-4 times on the show so far, and it's a lot of fun. How did it come about?
Well, basically, there's not much of a story. There was a two-piano group at UC San Diego, and they said, write us a piece, and it was the dumbest title I could come up with.
But it's not a dumb piece.
Well, I mean, compared to my other pieces, maybe. It's pretty dumb. The only thing I'd say, it's a strict 12-tone piece, and the reason for that is because I was in Amsterdam at the time, actually in the same house that you stayed at, as we talked about the Ritter residence.
We almost stayed at, yeah. We almost got the sublet. Yeah.
Okay, well, I did stay there. And basically, it's a 12-tone piece, but I decided to improve on usual 12-tone techniques, because usually you can't tell whether the tone row is going right side up or upside down. So I figured that basically what I do is, if the tone row is going right side up, I double it in major triads, and if it's going upside down, I double it in minor triads.
Just what we need, triads in 12-tone music. That's what it's for.
Yeah, I think, yes, that's what it is for. It's basically a way to extend the tonal hegemony of Germany for the next 100 years or whatever.
Absolutely.
Whatever Schoenberg was hoping for. So I thought I'd just give him a little assist after it was an obsolete technique. So that's Bonzo for you.
Okay, well, let's hear it. It'll take us past the hour. So you're listening to Calvis and Damien's New Music Bazaar. Your red alert for new music here on WGDR Plainfield. And here it is, Bongo Bonzo by Eric Lyon. Thank you. Bongo Bonzo by Eric Lyon. That played by the thump piano duo of Drew Krause, who's been on the show, and Paul Marquardt, who hasn't been on the show. From the piano duo CD available from Frog Peak Music. Eric Lyon, we have got no time left. We have one piece to play. If you gave us 30 seconds of we'll time you.
Okay.
And also, you should sell something.
Sell something?
Yeah.
Well,
use your marketing expertise to sell some of your music.
Well, I have a Timex watch that somebody can have for $10 if they like it.
That'll do.
Well,
yeah.
If they can come to my webpage, just go to www.dartmouth.com. I mean .edu.
Then
look for the music section and look for me, and that's how you can contact me, and maybe we can work something out. So we're gonna, I think, listen to 1981. Is that right? And this is the last electronic piece I composed in Japan, and it's sort of really the only sort of quasi-serious piece that we're going to hear, sort of looking at America from another place. And so there's stuff about Viagra and the bombings in Iraq and you know, just all kinds of fun things. So we'll just let you throw it on and see how you like it.
Okay.
Take it, dude.
Thanks, Eric Lyon, for being our guest today. We hope we can get you back since you're nearby and a professor now.
Oh, yeah, I'll come back next week.
Oh, good. You can be on the show with Phil Klein.
I love Phil Klein.
Okay.
What a guy.
Here it is. Music by Eric Lyon. We will have to postpone our look at the declining look at the music of the 20th century for this week because we don't have time for it. So here it is. See you next week. 1981 by Eric Lyon.
You can't imagine some of the things that have been done to people.
Even get an erection anymore.
Oh, my
God.
truth is real, and error is unreal. Error is accounted for truth. Divine science insists that time will prove all this. Both truth and error have come nearer than ever before to the apprehension of mortals, and truth will become still clearer as error is self-destroyed.
Mind can impart purity instead of impurity, strength instead of weakness, and health instead of disease. Truth is an alterative in the entire system and can make it every whit whole. Remember, brain is not mind. Matter cannot be sick, and mind is immortal. existence of matter, and you admit that mortality, and therefore disease, has a foundation in fact. Deny the existence of matter, and you can destroy the belief in material conditions. When fear disappears, the foundation of disease is gone. Once let the mental physician believe in the reality of matter, and he is liable to admit also the reality of all discordant conditions.
a production of Multimedia.